Everybody, welcome. Thank you for taking some time to join us today. I'm just trying to get all my stuff set up. All right. I'll go ahead and give folks about a minute or so to join before we get started. I just have a couple introductory info slides for y'all before we really dive into our conversation today. In the meantime, if you want to take some time and pop in the chat your name, the organization that you're joining from as well, so we get a sense of who is all with us in the room today, that would be fantastic. Hi, Paul. Hi, Alyssa. Hi, Sharon. Sweet. All right. Looks like the waiting room has slowed down a little bit, so I'll go ahead and get started with these introduction slides to make sure y'all really have as much time as possible to hear from the folks who are not me today. So for all of you who have not met me before, my name is Emily Bernhardt. I use she/her pronouns. And I'm the Empathy Network Specialist at Woodland Park Zoo. And today we are having our learning group on applying empathy practices to biofact collections and related programming. So if you are new to the network or maybe haven't attended one of our learning groups before, I did just want to start with a quick introduction of who we are as a network. So the Advancing Conservation Through Empathy for Wildlife Network is a learning network that creates and shares effective practices to foster empathy for animals and people, leading to conservation actions. We are currently made up of 27 AZA-accredited zoos and aquariums throughout the United States, and staff at those organizations, like the ones that we'll be presenting today, are our network members. We also have over 100 affiliates at 70-plus organizations worldwide. And as a network, we define empathy as a stimulated emotional state that relies on the ability to perceive, understand, and care about the perspectives of another person or animal. And I can go ahead and drop a link to our resource library in the chat once I am done with these, in case any of you would like to peruse kind of more of those foundational resources that result in this definition a little bit more. Before we get started, I just wanted to plug we have some upcoming events in April that I wanted to mention. So we have another learning group in about 2 weeks on animal fact sheets and empathy practices. We also have the open meeting for the steering committee on the 16th. And if this again is your first network event or you're new to the network and really want to kind of get a foundation under you about who the network is, what we do, and learn a little bit more about empathy practices, we will be hosting an introduction session at the end of April, and you can get a introduction to all of those sorts of things, and I'll drop the link to all of these in the chat as well in just a second. But you are not here to listen to me today. You are here to listen to our wonderful presenters. So we have three folks from across our network who are going to be sharing on their biofact-related projects. So we'll be hearing from Christine at the Minnesota Zoo talking about the Ivory Lab program. And then we'll hear from Mackenzie at Woodland Park Zoo talking about docent biofact guides. And then Shanna at the Zoological Society in Milwaukee is going to bring us home talking about some biofact evaluation tools. After we hear from all of our presenters, we're going to go into some small group discussions where you can select the speaker that you kind of want to chat with a little bit more and have discussions in these three individual breakout rooms. And then before we close, we'll come back and do some share outs Q&A for everybody. If you have any questions at any point during the presentations, feel free to drop them in the chat. And this recording will be shared out with anybody who registered, as well as the general network, typically within a week. But I'm going to go ahead and stop screen sharing and pass it over to you, Christine, to talk about the Ivory Lab.
All right, well, thank you. And so we had a lot of people online, so that's awesome. I'm going to try and share my screen now. So hopefully you guys can see the big elephant. Yes. Yay, it worked.
Yes.
I was telling Emily we had some internet issues out here today. And it wasn't working. So, but yeah, so my name is Chris Ness, and officially here at the zoo, I am the biofact coordinator, and I also teach classes here. So I kind of pull double duty. One of the things that we recently kind of created was something called the Ivory Lab. And just for a quick background, because I know every zoo kind of classifies biofacts a different way. And so for us at the Minnesota Zoo, when we say biofact, we are talking about a biological artifact. So basically a remain, something that was part of, or in the case of a bird nest, was built by a living animal. And we, as of today, we just counted, we have 3,126 pieces in the system of real biological artifacts. So we don't count plastic skulls or anything like that. Those are in a separate bin. And when we were looking at our ivory collection, we have about 56 pieces at the zoo. Most of them are elephant. We have a couple walrus pieces and a couple of sperm whale teeth that are scrimshawed and are really, honestly, very beautiful. And we were looking at, how do we use these items in a meaningful way, and how do we make sure that, we're being respectful to the fact that they are a remain, right? They're teeth, and we want to make sure that we're being respectful in that way. And we created the lab because we have really two zoo camps. One is called Wildlife Heroes and one is called Wildlife Agents, and they both look at the animal trafficking problem. And unfortunately, historically, the ivory was not being used in a very meaningful way. It was kind of like a poaching is bad, pass this around, look at it, now you're done. And there wasn't a lot of context, and there wasn't a lot of anything for it. And things developed a little bit, and then they started using it as a substance to test fingerprinting on, which you can fingerprint anything. I don't know why they chose to use an ivory bracelet to practice fingerprinting on. The way that they were doing it, using clear tape to lift the print off of the surface, was not exactly, from a museum setting, not the best thing to do with ivory. And my lights just went off. So that was not the best way to treat the ivory. And so we didn't want to damage the ivory. We wanted to make it meaningful. And so we created the lab situation. So one, we could use the collection and use it more effectively. And two, kind of recreate an experience that maybe a wildlife agent would have. That's what these camps were basically focused around, is combating wildlife crime. And rather, the agents don't just pass around an ivory bracelet. How do you figure out that it's actually ivory? We wanted students to think about different careers with wildlife. We didn't want them to just think of, because everybody's like, I want to be a keeper. Well, there's so many other ways to go that you can help wildlife. And so this was a bit of an eye-opening for a lot of our students, because they didn't, well, I really like art. Well, okay, let's talk about how you could draw this and this, art, and make it a forensics class on how to draw ivory or something like that. And so it kind of really expanded what the students were thinking about when they talked about animal careers. And then probably the hardest side, you talk about the people on both sides of the ivory trade, right? It's not just the good guy, the bad guy, the elephant, the not elephant. There's a lot of different sides to it, and how deep do you want to go into that? So the gist of how it works is actually pretty easy. We ordered a bunch of plastic, get them on Amazon, jewelry trays with the nice velvet liners, and we, not only with our ivory pieces that we had, and we did choose pieces that were, if it was a little elephant figurine, we gave them the ones that already had a broken leg. It already had some nicks and stuff in it. We didn't give them the museum display pieces, but we gave them the jewelry trays, and then we had the ivory pieces. We had different pieces of bone from our collection that maybe busted off of something. We didn't know what to do with them anymore. Hey, let's put them in the ivory lab. We had other teeth. We probably all have a drawer of random teeth somewhere. We had plastic. We used those vegetable ivories, the tagua nuts. And then when it came time to kind of do the lab, we had UV black lights, magnifying glasses, and then we had a bunch of other educational materials and visuals to kind of help support the kids. And they basically get a tray with 6 to 7 pieces in it. And it is important for the teacher to set it out in the way that it's pictured, because that definitely helps the students. Because if it gets mixed up, sometimes our teachers aren't real good at being able to identify it if it's their first time teaching it. So to put it, on the tray, they can kind of look to see which pieces are which. And we have a couple of different ways that they can test for ivory, but the two biggest ones are here on the slide. They look for those Schrieger lines, which are the cross hatching lines in the ivory. Some of them are extremely easy to find. Some of them, when we get to our older kids, are extremely not easy to find. And we have one piece that I think we gave it to college kids, and I think only half of them figured it out because it's a tiny little piece. It doesn't fluoresce like the others do under that UV light. That UV light test, of course, you got to make sure with fifth and sixth graders that they're not shining it at each other's eyeballs. But it is really cool to go into a closet, a black room, and they get to shine that light about 12 inches from their tray. And yeah, the ivory usually lights right up. Unfortunately, sometimes so does the different teeth you put in there, because what's ivory? A tooth. And so sometimes the other teeth light up as well. So then they have to use steps two and three and look for the Schrieger lines and look for the other things. And so sometimes it's super easy, sometimes it's not. We have had the Ivory Lab has kind of had a little spin-off already where we have a wildlife age, we have, what is it, Vanishing Animals, which is a school-based program. So these other programs were based through our zoo camp where we had, they're here for a week, we had a little bit more time. But the Ivory Lab spun off into a Vanishing Animals class, like schools come class, and where they get to, the students break off into groups of, I think, like 5 or 6, and they get to unpack a piece of luggage that's been flagged at TSA. And some of them have, ivory in it. Some of them have fake pangolins and fake animals being smuggled across the border. Some of them have, is it legal leather? Is it illegal leather? And so they get to kind of go through it all. And one of the steps is, yeah, if they think they find a piece of ivory, they take it back to the lab and check it for its reality. And then here are some of the questions that we're working on. And if you guys have great answers, share, please. One of the big ones is how do you, when we're talking about empathy, how do you talk about wildlife conflict, trafficking, illegal trade, or whatever, without making it an us versus them situation? Some of this stuff is very culturally focused. How do you talk about tiger trafficking in Southeast Asia without making it a cultural us them? How do you acknowledge traditions and ceremony in the modern world? Sometimes, how do you do that? I don't know. This is one we talk about a lot with even some of the younger kids, but is it okay to have empathy for the people who participate in the illegal wildlife trade, but no empathy for the actions that they take? Watching fifth and sixth graders argue about that has been, they have some big conversations. And then, the last one is nothing happens in a bubble, and we need to figure out the reasons why these things are happening. And the thing we give to the kids all the time is like, this is a complicated issue. It's not black and white. And so that is, and there's all of our critters that give us our ivory. When we do the bigger program, It's usually when we do the zoo camp version of it, it can be about a half an hour because we go through all the different kinds of where ivory comes from, and talk about where the ivory comes from, and then we talk about, the different animals, and then how like elephant trafficking has changed to push other animals into situations of being trafficked as well. And so, yeah, it's the stuff that we've been able to do so far has been really fun and really amazing. We haven't run this program a ton yet to know exactly what's working and what's not, but it's definitely got a very good start. That's all I have for right now.
Awesome. Thanks, Christine. All right, Mackenzie, I will pass it off to you next.
Yeah, all right. Hi, everybody. I want to apologize firsthand for my dog. She will be making appearances today. I'm going to share this document with everybody. All right, does that look okay?
Yes, we can see the document.
Beautiful. All right, so what we're doing here, this is a project in collaboration with my advisors at the university, as well as with the volunteer engagement department at Woodland Park Zoo. So the what and why of this project is the development of a guide to give docents and the individuals, the educators that are hands-on working directly with these objects, the tools to create in very positive, effective, long-lasting interactions that further empathy for the objects themselves, the animals that are connected to these objects, the living counterparts, and so on. Namely, this guide is developed in response to questions. I call them the hard questions, capital H, capital Q. Things like, why did it die, and how did it die? Why did you kill it? The things that the 5, 6, 7, 8 year olds are asking us on a daily basis. And that also branches into other sensitive topics like spirituality, religion, ethics, morality, some of the things we've already talked about today. So what this project is rooted in is going to be inquiry-based learning, IBL, which essentially is, put in the most simplest terms, student-led, learner-led. So what we're doing is we're setting up these foundations for effective interactions where we are guiding the learners through, but they are asking the good questions themselves. They are coming to the conclusions themselves, and we are just guiding them gently in the right direction. These hard questions, things like I said, how did it die, and why did you kill it, are these questions that these little kids are asking us all the time. But also things like, when it died, did it go to heaven, or other questions that are in no way our place as scientific educators to align with one way or the other. These guests are coming to us from with their own backgrounds and their own unique experiences, which speaks to a couple other things that we're incorporating here, a couple other foundational principles. It's going to be social emotional learning, and of course the constructivist learning theory, which is a big deal for me personally, and that this is where the equity for the learner comes in, where they are going to be coming to us with these past experiences, pa previous knowledge that they've already built through their lives, through school, camps, etc. And we are going to interact with these previous, honor them, honor their pre-existing knowledge, and add to it and build upon it with them. There's a few other principles we're looking at here. Namely, Woodland Park Zoo's empathy bridge. So, of course, that goes from when you're having this interaction with people, and this applies to the living animals at zoos, aquaria, etc. You're going to start with assuring welfare and well-being, introducing the animal as an individual, highlighting their autonomy and choice, informing the audiences of the animal's unique story traits, getting to know, almost personify the animal a little bit, but not too far to anthropomorphize. Invite the audience to observe, take perspective, and encourage care for its species. And all of these things can be molded together into what we're calling visual thinking strategies in science. This is a principle that has been developed by a few different organizations across the nation, but it's still in its infancy how it's being applied. And I found an opportunity to apply it really beautifully with docents at zoos that are working firsthand with these objects. So what we're doing through this workshop, where we're training the docents, interacting with them. Again, this guide was originally developed after a focus group with Woodland Park Zoo docents, asking what it is that they could benefit from, what it is that they're looking for help with, support with, etc. So this is a response to that. And visual thinking strategies is an inquiry-based learning framework that incorporates all the great things about social emotional learning and constructivism and all those big buzzwords that I already mentioned earlier. So, in traditional visual thinking strategies, we're looking at these three questions. We set up a piece of artwork. We say, what's going on in this picture? What do you see that makes you say that? And what more can we find? And that is all highlighted with pointing and paraphrasing and essentially, we create this space for learners to be open, vulnerable, accepted, welcome, safe. And there is, with art, there is no right or wrong answer. Of course, with science, there are some right and wrong answers. Things like when we're looking at a biofact, and it's, let's say, we're looking at a lion or a wolf, and the child says that's a bear. That is factually incorrect. But with VTSS, these ideas are acknowledged and addressed instead of correcting, saying, well, actually, this is a, we're going to say things like, what do you see that makes you say this is a bear? The child, what we're doing here with this child is we're honoring the connections that they've already built because they saw a skull. They saw that belonged to an animal. They saw it belonged to an animal that probably had sharp teeth, is large. And they already made all these connections and jumped to it's a large carnivorous mammal. And it's really, really easy to jump completely over that and go, well, that's not actually a bear, it's a lion. And here's why. Instead, I want to know the connections. I want to know more about the connections that they already built with this object. And by doing this, the idea is that we are allowing learners, namely children, to interact with these objects on a personal level, to explore their stories in a way that already makes sense for them because these learners are setting up their path themselves. And what we're doing as facilitators, what our job is as facilitators, is to listen, to watch, to understand, and to accept these processes. In this workshop, we also walk through some scenarios here about what it looks like to invite inquiry, what it looks like to talk about complicated issues like death and dying. And then, of course, we're going to end the workshop with a series of guided questions on what do we like about this? What is working? What isn't working? And that is where we will. Did I? So sorry, guys. Did I finish my screen sharing?
We no longer see your screen.
Beautiful. Okay. So that is where we are entering this world of inquiry-based learning. And that's the point of this project here, is to give docents the tools to talk about these hard questions that always come up when we're working with biofacts. And this is something that can be overlaid on other programming to practice how to teach and how to learn in ways that are accessible for everyone and that are effective in developing empathy and care for not just these objects and the animals that they belong to, but the living counterparts, and even further using this development of empathy to inspire conservation action. And so on and so forth. So you can see where the empathy bridge plays comes into play, and you can see where the these other really wonderful principles are enacted in order to reach a wide audience and instill care and compassion. And so this project is still about halfway complete. It's going to be complete in June and published. So I'm really open to any questions or queries about that. But yeah, so that's what I'm working on personally. I'm really happy to share it with you and talk more about visual thinking strategies and visual thinking strategies in science.
Awesome. Thank you, Mackenzie. All right, we will hand it over to Shanna to take us home with the final presentation before we split for a little bit into our breakout rooms with the individual presenters.
Hi all. I'm having some major connectivity issues, so if I drop off or audio drops out, if someone could give me a little sign. So I thought I would split my time between two major topics involving biofacts, one being the evaluation piece and how we are doing some light evaluation around biofact use with our classes and then our outreach events. And then I thought I would talk about the other piece that I have mostly focused on after our ACE for Wildlife grant concluded, and that is the care and maintenance of our collection and how that is related to empathy for wildlife and how we talk about the care and maintenance of that collection with other people. So I'm going to share my screen. Let me share this. So can everybody see the document okay?
Yes, we can.
Yes, perfect. Okay. So, what I did was I took our MECAP tool that we use for live animal encounters, and I modified it to include more of the questions that we tend to see from kids when they're interacting with biofacts, and sometimes adults. Some of the things that Mackenzie, you were saying, like they ring real true. Like, did you kill it? One kid asked, our manager of innovation and community engagement, did you rip this thing's bones out? Which is a really horrific way of asking if we were the culprits behind the death of the animal. But what I did was I kind of made it a form where people can just take this anywhere. Like we take a lot of biofacts off-site for our innovation and community engagement things that we do out in the community. So I wanted this to be something that was a little shorter than the traditional MECAP that people could receive just a little bit of training on, but still do on the fly because we only have one evaluator on staff for public programming. So I shortened a couple of the categories, but the ones that are specific to biofacts are, let me scroll down here. Expresses concern for an individual animal's well-being after viewing the biofact. Particularly, we found that animals with faces tend to generate this kind of questioning and this kind of concern for animals. If we're bringing out like a sample of cheetah fur, we tend not to get that question. But if we bring out the full pelt, we tend to get that question a lot. And taxidermy as well provokes that question. So anytime someone expresses an animal's well-being asking if we personally were the people responsible. That's where I would check that off. And I'm Mackenzie, you're like, do they go to heaven? I don't have anything on here for that because I've not heard that one yet, but I can't believe I haven't. Because at the museum, I used to hear things along that line. So I might have to go back and add something to this form. And then demonstrating care behavior or beneficial action, even though the animal is not alive, I still wanted people to be able to mark those things down because when I show you the next piece of what I want to talk about, having kids interact with the biofact gently is an important way of showing whether they understand the importance of the animal even after it is has passed on. So making sure that, like, if we tell them the tiger pelt, you want to brush against the, or not against the grain of the fur with it, like you're petting a cat at home. If they're just kind of like running their hands all over it, or if they're like throwing like a piece of a skull, you know, like the top part of it to their teammate, we want to make sure that we are recording that. And we've had, you know, unfortunately, some instances where we have taken things like offsite that have returned broken, because kids were not being careful with them. But to me, that's valuable information because it demonstrates how they, you know, how they are currently feeling about the value of that object. And that's like a tougher nut to crack, I think. But right now, gathering data on that, I think, is important. And then recognition of the animal as an individual. So this to me is important too, because it seems like this type of thing can transcend whether the animal is alive or not. And that is indicated by we take these animals, these taxidermy pieces off site, and students really want to give them a name. And we, you know, we don't anthropomorphize, we don't do the taxidermy where like our like gray squirrel has like a little hat on or something like that. But we do ask the kids, like, what do you think their name would be? So we have like Dr. Soul the skunk. That lives in our office, and kids named him as such, and we voted on it. And now, when we take him out, we say like that's his name because some kids, you know, at an event thought that that fit his personality, like how he's posed and everything. So, but we would have kids greeting the animal as such, like saying hi, Dr. Soul, bye, Dr. Soul. So, I think that that's important too, because even though it is now an object and not a living thing, we are still seeing empathy output where they are like speaking to the taxidermy as if they would to an animal that, you know, was moving around inside of its habitat. So again, I'm using this to just capture some very preliminary data about that on our offsite excursions. I have used it occasionally in classes as well. But we are just now like evaluating our increased biofact usage based on the fact that we are no longer taking animals off site, like live animals off site because of, you know, empathy reasons. So I imagine this document will see an increase in usage, and then I might have more data to report back on. And I'm happy to share this as well post meeting. And if anyone has any feedback on things that they think belong on here, I would love to hear it because it is a working document. Emily, how am I doing on time?
You got a couple more minutes if you want to keep going.
Sure. Okay. The next thing I am going to pull up is the talking about the care and maintenance of objects. Can everyone see the smushed tiger?
We still see the mecap,
Oh, okay.
eval tool.
All right, let me stop sharing. And start sharing again. Picture of a tiger. Does everyone see this?
We now see smushed tiger, yes.
Okay. So, one of the major things that I did as an offshoot of doing the work with our Building Crew grant with ACE for Wildlife was I started to be interested in how we care and maintain, care for and maintain our collection. So, this is just one example of, how lack of care for an item or a lack of maintenance can lead to damage to the item, sometimes permanent, sometimes irreparable. So this is a tiger pelt. This tiger did not live with us. This was a donation from many, many, many years ago. But as you can see, like I hope the photo does it justice, this face is completely squished in like this. And children found it disturbing. We generally would like fold it under because it looks pretty bad. And to me, this seemed like it did not do service to the animal and is not the most empathetic way to display this animal and talk about this animal. So what I set out to do is to repair it. And let's see if I can. So you can see it's pretty flat. And we use this in our program called Jaws, Claws, and Paws. So this is kind of like the star of that program. And as you can see, like it's pretty damaged. But in the process of trying to find, in the process of repairing it, what I wanted is to be able to have them show the full face to the students and talk about the adaptations of the whiskers and like the eyes and all of that, which at the moment we were not able to do. So what I did was I built a model using the tiger skull. And then I cut that out and filled it. And you can see the sample model right there. And I wove more around it to accommodate for the musculature of the head. And here's it sitting on the model of the head. We soaked it in water. You can do like a combination of water or salt water. But I laid it on top of this mold. And this is the after product where you can see that it's now like a full tiger face. It's no longer smushed. And we are able to now use that in our programs. And the face is like holding its shape a lot better. In addition to doing things like repairs, we did a full inventory of our biofact collection. So now people are able to go into our storage area and pull those items out and find them a lot easier, which is in which led to an increase in biofact usage this past summer. So I tracked it last summer and I'm going to track it again this summer. And I am thinking that we are going to see at least a 30% increase in the use of our collection because of how it is stored and maintained at the moment. We went through the Milwaukee Public Museum to get information on how to store our collection. And what I did was I took that and scaled it back a bit because we are obviously using a teaching collection. So at the end of the day, we don't need to store everything in like, very, very specific boxes that, have like, humidity controls in each of the cabinets. But we ended up doing that anyway, just because of the location that the items are stored in. So I'm happy to share the like a sample of our inventory if anyone is looking to do that. And then also the care and maintenance guide that I used for restoring the tiger pelt. If anyone has the same conundrum where they have like, something that has been kind of smushed beyond repair, it takes about a week and it takes a lot of room and you really have to soak. Like you put an entire pelt inside of or the head inside of water. And it's a little scary, but it turns out really nice. And that's, I think I've probably gone over, Emily. I'm sorry.
No worries. That was a incredible restoration. That was really cool to see. All right. So we now have some time. If y'all would like to chat with one of the presenters more in depth about anything they discussed, if you have questions about the tools that they presented, anything with their programs, if you would like to engage with some of the questions that each of the presenters posed, they're still wrestling with themselves. We'll be in these breakout rooms for about 10 or 12 minutes to start these discussions and make some connections. And then we'll come back into the main space for the last 5 minutes or so and see if there's any general Q&A that maybe didn't get a chance to get asked in those breakout rooms. And yeah, if any guides or documents, if folks are willing to share those, I can send those out to all of the registrants afterwards if y'all just want to send those to me, because I think there's a lot of potential opportunity for really cool stuff to be done with all of these tools. So I'm going to go ahead and open the breakout rooms. Shanna, Christine, and Mackenzie, I've already placed you in your rooms. Everybody else, you should be able to self-select which room you would like to go to, and we'll be in there for about 12 or so minutes, and the rooms should be open now.
Hello,
Everybody. Oh, there we go. Welcome back, everybody.
hello.
Awesome. Got some folks popping back in, and I'll have some time for some general questions before we close. All right. Welcome back into this main space, everybody. We have a little shy of 10 minutes left. Hope y'all had some good conversations in the rooms that you went to. But I wanted to make sure folks had some time to ask questions of all presenters for a couple minutes before we closed out the meeting today. Feel free to raise your hand, come off mute, or pop your question in the chat, and then I can read it off. There's a question from Ben, and I'm assuming that this is for Shanna. What do the numbers on the evaluation document mean?
Sorry, I wanted to just quick look at the document to see if I was missing any numbers. They're just the number like in that particular category. So there's two subcategories in that category. They don't have any other deeper meaning, especially because they don't link exactly to the MECAP because some of them are different or modified. So they're just for me to keep track. Like, so if I want to say on the BioFact thing, like 13 kids showed like number one in that category. I know what that means. Yeah, sorry, it's not a scoring system. I tend to do because it's usually just me, and because we can see upwards of like 1,000 kids sometimes with those interactions. I do a presence absence, and if I can, like I will try and take notes. But if you have time and you have multiple people that can like go around and use the document, you can certainly have them like score every single person that they see that does that behavior. But we found that with outreach events like Juneteenth Day or Family Free Day, you know, we're seeing like so many people, the volume is impossible for one dedicated person to just sit there and like keep track of those things. And because they're outreach events, the tabling tends to be such a short-lived thing that you're not following a kid around like an exhibit or like a habitat. You are just kind of looking at them like look at a wolf pelt and go, huh, and like maybe make a comment or two, and then they move on. So presence absence is usually a little better for that. But if you want to use it for a more extended thing, like a class, for example, then you could do where you would pick a kid or two and follow them throughout the interaction. Sorry, that was a long answer.
Thank you. I have another question. Curious what the training process for BioFact use is like at other institutions. Do you have mandatory training? Do you have no training but optional workshops, training for both staff and volunteers? I wonder if each presenter could give a brief kind of overview of what that looks like, or if folks across this Zoom room want to pop it in the chat what their org looks like, that would be great as well.
I can go real quick. We have training for both staff, education staff, and volunteers. It looks a little bit different depending on what you're doing, if it's a classroom versus out in the main zoo grounds, just based on crowd control and things like that. But yeah, both get training. And then for that second question that popped up about language and how what we call things, we don't get real specific about that. When I'm training people, I actually remind them that they're physical remains of an animal, but that's only in training, and that's kind of to boost their empathy and getting them to think about it's not just a thing, it's an actual biological remain. I have found that that creates the staff to treat things better. It's not just a feather, it's a, you know, it's a thing. Whatever whatever our staff is comfortable. If it's a pelt, if it's a fur, it's a skin. We're pretty loose with that.
I have found sometimes using monetary value of things or the cost of repair as a gentle reminder to people to, if they are not prone to treating objects with empathy. Thankfully, we haven't had, many instances of that, but reminding people like, hey, please package this skull gently because it would cost us $800 to get another one. Or like, hey, we should probably take good care of this pelt because we will not get another one. Like, there will not be a tiger that dies on site that we will be able to retain its pelt, just for, the way things are now with, the exchange between the zoo. Like, there are bigger fish that get those items before we do now. So taking care of our collection is not only empathetic, but it ensures that we have these items to interpret with beyond, the scope of our careers, hopefully, that these items will continue to serve, like, even beyond that.
Awesome. And then there's a message from Claire in the chat around Woodland Park Zoo's docent training. So for the docents, they participate in an 8-week-long training program, which covers general interpret strategies as well as how to work with and interpret biofacts with visitors. A lot of this is led by existing docents, but we are currently exploring how to further incorporate staff and new best practices as we work with a broader docent community and integrate biofact usage amongst staff. So it looks like we have time for one more question. So Courtney, I'm going to use yours to close us out. Do we all use the word biofacts, or are there more empathetic descriptors used? The one I use is still specimen, but that feels very sterile. What are the words that folks use to describe these sorts of artifacts?
I can speak, I guess, start to speak on that. Biofacts is obviously the term that we use in the institution if I'm trying to communicate what's going on here with fellow staff, with docents, volunteers, etc. But a lot of people don't know that word, what that means. They obviously know artifact, they know drawing the difference between like biological artifact as opposed to other forms of physical specimens in different, yep, Karen said the exact same thing in different disciplines. But I, through this inquiry-based learning, and I think transparency is so effective when you're talking about these sensitive topics, saying exactly what it is and encouraging the learners, the audience, to use the part of the body that it's representing. Even using it as a, a deeper learning opportunity for understanding like what things are called. So instead of a claw, maybe it's a talon or otherwise, for example. And I think that that's an amazing way to build empathy is to describe what it is, what it came from, to honor the animal that it's coming from. But also use it as almost a learning opportunity and personalize it to the animal. It's not just a bone, it's a femur, it's a leg bone. With kids, that works really beautifully because then they're also able to learn, use language skills and learn about like the parts of the body and things like that. And they always love to be like, I know where the leg is or I know where the elbow is, like these little 4-year-olds. And it can really personalize and build some really great connections using those specific terms.
Can I add to this a little bit to this conversation, especially what we know in terms of our empathy initiative, that when we're talking about our living animals here, we want to use their pronouns, she, he, they like each other, that kind of thing. And I think maybe we should start down the path of doing the same things to biofacts. So you may have a piece of tiger pelt, right? There's no head, there's no tail, but it's a piece of tiger pelt. And somebody is exploring it, and you'll get those questions like, where did you get this? I think it's really important if you know where this pelt came from. We have one piece of tiger pelt. Well, I know where that tiger pelt came from. It was an animal that lived here about, oh, I don't know, 33 years ago, who passed away. He was 22 years old, a 22-year-old tiger when he passed away. And so I just tell kids that he was a tiger that lived here and he passed away when he was very old, 22. And so we have some of his fur so that he can continue teaching kids about how amazing tigers are. In that sentence, I'm saying he. Now, if I didn't know that this tiger was from, this pelt was from that tiger, I can still use the term he or she, because it really doesn't matter. It's a skull, it's a tooth, it's a whatever, but we can extend our empathy towards animals and these biofacts by giving them a he or a she pronoun designation. Most animals are a he or she. The concept of they is a human concept. There's a few hermaphrodites out there in the, the animal world, but for the most part, they're a male or female. And that's another way that we can extend this empathy to an inanimate skull, kind of increasing the empathy that it was a living creature, a sentient being at one point. So that should, I think, be maybe a part of philosophical change. It's not it. So she's still around and helping teach kids about how amazing an impala is.
I think one of the things too, and this is probably a much bigger conversation, is we sat down with some of our keepers and asked them how they felt about us using the names of the animals themselves. And some of them had quite a strong reaction to that because they work with the animals every day and they have like a relationship with them that they, one of them said it would be like putting my grandma on a table and like using her, like interpreting with her, which I thought was a very, I was not anticipating that reaction. But it seems like there's like a graph, like distance and time from like the person's memory, it becomes a lot more like acceptable to use the names and history of the animal. Like we have a wolf pelt from the 90s, and no one is like upset that we use like that wolf's name and say, like, in the 90s, they lived here, they lived a long life, and then they passed away, and we're still learning from them because you can't get close to a wolf like this in real life, or you shouldn't. But if a tiger or, an animal were to die now when we were to acquire that pelt, I don't know that we would use the animal's name, or that we would have to have a much bigger conversation about that because in living memory, like, or in like employment memory, people remember that animal and it might be very upsetting to some people. We still need to do some digging on that, but it is an interesting viewpoint that we had not considered, and I think needs a little more exploration. That's all.
Yeah, I'm definitely, I know this is something that came up at the summit as well as a topic of interest. So I'm kind of seeing this as like part one of a many part biofact interpretation series, which I personally am so in for. So be ready for more of those coming down the pipeline. But I do want to be respectful of folks' time. We've already kind of gone over our allotted hour, but this is such a good conversation. Thank you all for staying over a couple of minutes. And we will share out those resources with everybody shortly. And thank you all for being here. And I hope that this leads to some further thought conversations and cool work down the line. Thank you all for coming and have a good rest of your day.